Yeah, and so I guess like where I'm trying to bring this whole conversation is to that point, which is to say that's actually the Anabaptist vision of the church, is that medieval vision of the church, that the church is like it's wholly consistent with medieval Christianity and with first millennium Christianity. And it's just this idea that there's the earthly institution of the church and there's the heavenly institution of the church. And they're kind of two separate things, kind of the same thing. It's not obvious to us how that always works out, but one thing that we know is that the Christian is the stranger, and what that means is that he's kind of always going to be at odds with these things that are over here on the earthly side of things.
You get to take a kind of comfort in that
Now, just
if you're the Christian who's frustrated with your church, then it would be easy to just like nurse your frustration and just be like angry and bitter and crusty about everything because the church is doing everything wrong. But you can have much more peace about the situation if your attitude is, it is the nature of things for the church to do things wrong, and it is the nature of the Christian to, to challenge it in its errors. And sometimes that'll go well for you, and sometimes it won't go well for you. But that's the way that things are. And so, if I'm going to be the good Christian here, then I need to try to oppose what's wrong, and then whatever happens, happens.
Welcome to The Sacred Life. I'm your host, Aaron Beachy, coming to you from Higher Ground Fellowship in Kokomo, Indiana. And we at Sacred Life are dedicated to practical Christian ideas. And today, our topic of discussion will be the question of a national religion. And David, I'm going to let you. We have obviously with us today David,
It's me, I'm
Baylor.
John. I'm David.
John
Others
Baylor.
said I'm John. That's John.
But David's going to introduce our topic of discussion today. David, what is this? Why are you promoting a state religion?
Okay, so I'm not exactly promoting the state religion. And one reason is because there's a little bit of confusion in modern times with the term religion. So, kind of what we're going to be doing in this conversation is stepping back in time 500 years, looking at the situation surrounding the Reformation, like 500 years and like the whole century, I guess, before that, like the late Middle Ages leading up to the Reformation. You have this idea of the church, and it's starting to really diverge in different directions at this time. So, like, especially what you have during the 1400s is there's this real sharp conflict between these ideas who see the church as primarily being an institution with a strict hierarchy, a strict order of things, very organized, very systematic, everything's defined and everything's in its proper place. And then the counter argument is these people who say, no, that's not right, put the power in the hands of people. The church is something that exists in heaven. And like, and that goes back in the Middle Ages all the way to Augustine, like we mentioned him in our last video, who lays out this that very picture of the church as being two separate things. So kind of he sees the church as being a heavenly institution that has its like its I forget how he phrased it, but like its earthly reflection or something like that. Maybe, I don't know if you are familiar with
I
that or
couldn't
not.
help you with your term.
So like when we're talking about religion, we're not talking about like an organized institution and like a set of rules and set of doctrines and like an institution and a group of people and a kind of like a pseudo government that's ruling over everything. Instead, I guess in modern times, maybe we would say we're talking more about a philosophy.
Wait, are you saying everybody in the nation should have the same religion?
What I'm saying is that it's inevitable that everybody kind of has to, but actually not everybody, but the nation itself does.
Okay, everybody has to have the same religion, but not everybody.
Yes.
Okay.
I hope that's clear to everybody. No, actually what I'm saying is that the nation has to have a religion. The nation has to have a higher, something higher governing it. and the people are, you know, they're part of the nation. Now it's important. We were originally going to talk about like state religion, and John suggested we say national religion. I don't know.
The reason I made that distinction is just because to say state religion equates it very much with the government,
right?
And you know, government endorsed and government enforced and all of that. And I thought that probably wasn't the idea that you were going for. That you were talking about a sort of spiritual unity that exists between the people, in a sense, whether right. the government wants it to exist or not.
Yeah. So like when you're talking about a nation, at least to me, what comes to mind more is like the collective of the people.
Mm-hmm.
So like the people as a singular entity with like a singular animus, I guess you could mm-hmm. say. And so like that entity has to have a religion.
Okay.
And so like then the question then is, where does the individual fit in that picture? So like you're kind of, so like looking at America, we're looking at a state, a nation that essentially doesn't have a religion. And what has happened in America, because America doesn't have a national religion, is that America has actually ceased to be a nation in the sense of what a nation classically means.
Okay, so defend that a little bit. Why would you say America is not a nation?
Because it's not a unified people. It's fractured into lots of smaller nations.
So there's one sense, and I use this partly just because we're using the word nation. There's one sense in that we're not a unified people because genetically we're very different people from one another.
Yeah.
So we don't share a common cultural heritage. And so we might try, and this doesn't work very well, but we might try to claim Western civilization as our heritage because that fits more people than, say, claiming English or French or Swiss or German or Italian heritage or whatever, or Irish, you know. Then, like, naming off all those things, we can say, well, Western civilization is our heritage. Again, that simplifies it a little bit. Of course, that still excludes a lot of people, but you can't catch everybody
mm-hmm.
and still have a coherent identity.
Yeah.
So we're not the same people genetically with a common ancestry, but I assume that's not exactly what your thesis is there.
Yeah, right. So like I'm going to go and I'll frequently bring up this example of the empire in the Middle Ages, the Roman Empire or the Holy Roman Empire, usually just referred to it as the empire, whatever you want to call it, as being an example of that, where it is actually a nation because it is a people that are unified by a singular identity,
mm-hmm.
a singular ideal, but it's also ethnically and culturally extremely diverse.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean,
okay,
yeah.
So the Holy Roman Empire, you would say, begins in the year 1800, or you want to put it a little before then? That's
the Holy
Charlemagne
Roman Empire,
is,
800, not 1800. You're 1,000
800.
Years old.
Oh no, I thought I said 800.
Yeah.
Yes, I meant 800.
More or less, like it probably doesn't really begin until like a century after that.
Okay.
Otto the First, I think, is who they usually pin as being, here's the start of the,
okay.
of the Holy Roman Empire.
One thing I like about 800, even though I may have misspoken. is that because I was actually also thinking about the year 1800, so I might have said that, but one thing I like, it's just such a nice easy round number. Charlemagne was crowned Holy Roman Empire Emperor in the year 800, like
on New Year's Day.
That's very easy to remember. So
right, but it's also nice because that gives you a period of basically 1,000 years. Because,
which is why 1800 was in my mind, because
yeah.
because I think of it as roughly being 1,000 years. And I say this just because people who know a little bit about history often aren't very familiar with the Holy Roman Empire, even though it lasted for 1,000 years.
Right.
And
was like the single most important entity in Western history.
Yeah, right.
Right.
And so what would be the geographic expanse of the Holy Roman Empire?
For the most part, Germany, also including Austria and Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically the core of it. It also includes like most of what's today Poland for a lot of its, for most of its history, parts of what's now France, and
I mean, I would think pretty big parts of what's France, is that not true?
Not really.
Aww.
Just basically like the westernmost regions, also Lorraine, if you know anything about France.
Yeah.
And some areas down around, I guess some of what's now France around Switzerland was probably bent away.
Yeah.
Okay. And then also northern Italy, like everything north of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything around Rome and Ravenna was the Papal States, which was kind of under the empire to varying degrees.
Okay.
So like that's the extent of it.
Okay, so 800 to 1800, we can imagine those as being our dates, and then you can imagine that Germany down to Upper Italy and a little bit of France over to Poland and Austria. Okay, so I just wanted to give a little bit of scope of the empire.
Yeah, it was big.
Yeah,
not as big as the old Roman Empire, but. It was big, and it was very important.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't even know it existed. And part of it is because the people of the Enlightenment really hated the Holy Roman Empire, because it basically stood for everything the Enlightenment stood against.
Yeah, it's interesting that, we look back and we call it the Dark Ages, although we might specifically refer to, like, if you only refer to before the Holy Roman Empire as the Dark Ages, then it didn't last very long.
Yeah. Also, there wasn't really.
But if you want to call medieval Europe generally, if you want to call all of medieval Europe the Dark Ages, then this actually relates very much to this idea of the national religion. The reason you're going to call it the Dark Ages is because, in your view, they didn't accomplish anything intellectually. Philosophically, technologically, whatever. Like, you're going to say it was an uneducated time period, and they didn't have these sort of educated kind of accomplishments.
Yeah, and by the way, if you believe that, you're stupid.
Well, the reason you believe that is because, like, because you're not able to see what they did accomplish intellectually, because what they accomplished intellectually was really quite amazing. But it was all thoroughly Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And so if your worldview says, well, that religious stuff doesn't count, that doesn't count as intellectual accomplishment, or that doesn't count as philosophy, and their art doesn't really count as art because it was devoted to Christ. Like, right. If you're gonna rule everything out that's religious, then you look at that time period and say, what did these people do? They did nothing. but I mean, man, they had some real giants. In terms of philosophy,
right?
Throughout, what we call the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
Okay. So
Anyway, good.
The reason that relates very much to what you're saying is because these were a very united people.
Yeah.
And they were united around something that doesn't matter as much to us as modern people, and so therefore we don't see anything. Because the one thing that they were wholly devoted to, like, we're just kind of blind to it.
Well, yeah.
But again, that's a united society, and we're not, essentially.
Yeah, and like this is something that I think very few people are aware of, and like even surprises me, a student of the Middle Ages, when I come across it, just how thoroughly immersed in Christianity and like basically obsessed with Christianity anybody in the Middle Ages is.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's like everything they do centers around their religion. Like absolutely everything.
Right. Well, and I mean, if you're gonna list, this is kind of a little bit of the point that I was gonna make, but if you're gonna list like medieval thinkers, then they're just the goal of, I don't know if I want to say this, like, I don't know if understanding God, like, that sounds too much like you're in control, but I'll use the phrase anyways, like, the goal of their lives was to understand God. Every great thinker, during the whole, from before the fall of the Roman Empire, really, until the end of the Middle Ages, like, whether it's Thomas Aquinas or it's Anselm, or, you know, I mean, you go back, if you count Augustine in that time span,
right?
And Ambrose, who was a contemporary of his, you know, Boethius, like, I don't know who you would name who isn't obsessed with Christianity.
Right. Yeah, okay, so I guess, like, tying this all back into this discussion of a national religion, so we're painting this picture of here you have this period where you definitely have, like, something that is singularly uniting to the people, but it's something, like they would have said it, is something that is not of this world. So, like, again, just to reiterate that point, the medieval concept of the church is not the Bishop of Rome. Even though, like, obviously the Pope is an institution in the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not what you're talking about when you're talking about the medieval church. You're talking about, in their minds, in their own words, you're talking about something that exists in heaven. And what you have through the liturgy and the Mass, those are the same thing, just explaining what liturgy means.
Mm-hmm.
What you have through the Mass, through the clergy, through the buildings of the church, and through the hierarchy and the institutions of the church, is always thought of to be a dim reflection of the actual church.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I'm just really trying to hammer that point home to just to make sure you understand what I mean.
Yeah, it's like they exist to reveal,
mm-hmm.
You know, the priest or the Pope or whatever is a representative of something that exists.
Yeah, which by the way is the reason why a medieval cleric of any kind wears a vestment, is because when you put on the vestment, you are no longer yourself as a person, rather you are a reflection of this heavenly thing.
Mm-hmm.
So like that, this is the idea that medieval people are just completely fixated on, is this idea of the church. So they have a society that really is incredibly diverse and pluralistic, yet somehow united by something. And what you have happening, basically, I think after the Black Death, like the Black Death.
Oh, just to clarify, because we've been attacking this idea of pluralism. What do you mean when you say they were incredibly diverse and pluralistic? We've talked about what it means that they were.
Yeah,
united,
so
but...
I'm talking about. That's good to clear up that confusion. So, like, they're incredibly diverse in terms of their ethnicity, their language, their, I guess you could say, for lack of a better term, their political beliefs, even though politics isn't really a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sort of is, just not
yeah.
the way we think of it today.
Okay, so...
But they're also, this is an important point, they're also diverse in terms of their doctrine, religious doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something people are generally unaware of, is that the medieval church is actually incredibly diverse in terms of doctrine and teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And they were okay with it for the most part.
Yeah.
Like they stopped being okay with it at the end of the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the Reformation happens, is because you start getting this idea that, okay, like we need to settle all of these questions.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and the Germans think one way and the Italians
think
another way.
You sort of had that idea for a long time in Christian history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the, you know, like the quest of Constantine is, let's settle all of these questions.
Mm-hmm.
And the church definitely continues, you know, when some bad idea pops up, then we're going to have a council and we're going to settle the issue. So I don't know. I mean, what makes you say that that's something that happens at the end of the Middle Ages rather than like that's just a part of what the church does?
Okay, so that's a good look. Let's use the illustration of the Great Schism. Like a lot of our audience might not be very familiar with the Great Schism. That's the split between East and West. So basically Rome, what is today the Roman Catholic Church, some people might say is the split between the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church, except that's not actually what happened. The Great Schism pretty much never happened. Like that's the strange thing about the story, is that nobody cared about the Great Schism basically until the time of the Reformation. Like the people, like the bishops in Rome did, but the Germans didn't care. Like the Germans had frequent contact with the Greeks. The mutual excommunication between the clergy, like, was basically something that was only at the very top levels of the Roman and the Constantinople clergy.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody else cared at all about it. And so what point was I making?
I don't know. I was just kind of wondering, like, I mean, in the Crusades, Christians were like sacking cities of.
Right, but it's also important to point out that those were French.
Yeah.
The French were kind of jerks.
Yeah.
Like the medieval French were. So like, in as much as I guess you could say a more modern idea of an institutional Catholic Church exists in the Middle Ages, it's a French institution.
John asked the question about why you would think that the need or the urge to demand that things needed to be defined happened at the end of the Middle Ages.
Yeah, so I was bringing up the Great Schism as a point of illustrating. Here's how that wasn't something that mattered to people. The Great Schism happens in 1054. So here's how some things like that don't really matter to most people at the beginning of the second millennium. And then you go 400 years into the future, into the 15th century, and people are really arguing about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so
these things meaning specific points of doctrine.
Yeah, and like also it's during that time where the schism starts to become an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because like for one thing they have the Council of Florence, which is an effort supposedly to repair the schism. And some of the people at the council were perplexed by it. Also like it completely failed.
Yeah.
Like in all points. And like the Council of Florence is like the point where it becomes very clear that the Western Church is divided in a way that can never be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are divided in terms of ideology in a way that the church had never been before.
Okay, so you've painted this picture, to go back to the previous part of it, you painted this picture of the Holy Roman Empire as being diverse and quote-unquote pluralistic in terms of basically, to try to simplify what you said, cultural expressions, I mean expression of their culture, like the forms that their culture takes
right.
on. And in terms of theological belief. So they're very divided, diverse in those ways, and yet they're still unified. The whole nation is, everyone in the whole nation is obsessed with Christianity.
Yeah.
And,
this is also,
and everything they do with their lives is like, I mean, this may be too complimentary, but like, but they make a serious focus out of serving Christ and glorifying God with their actions. And they do that as a people, united as a people in that way.
Okay.
So we have this great unity, but we have a type of diversity that exists within it.
Right.
Okay, so there's the picture you were trying to paint.
Yeah. And so like this is the thing that is busted apart at the time of the Reformation. So here, I guess, is where I want to get to, is this idea of the Reformation, and especially the Anabaptists. So what's going on, so I'll go to Switzerland, and it's specifically the Canton of Bern during the time of the Reformation, just because it's what I'm the most familiar with, so the Reformation happens in Bern, the central government decides we're going to switch away from the Catholic religion and adopt the new Protestant faith. And that's how they themselves put it.
Mm-hmm.
Like those aren't words I'm putting in their mouth. Those are their own words. And along with that, they see the need, if we are going to survive as a state. Now here I'm using the word state on purpose instead of nation,
mm-hmm.
because state is important to Bern.
Yeah.
If we are going to survive as a state, we have to be unified. And I guess kind of the argument I am going to make is that they were actually right about that. If they were going to continue and survive and prosper as a state, they did have to be unified. But they had a false notion of what that meant. So how that worked out was, okay, a lot, like basically most of the rural people, especially the most conservative rural people in like the Emmental and the Oberland, the mountainous regions, rejected the Protestant religion. They said, we don't want this. We're okay if you, the city that rules over us, wants to have this, that's fine. We're not gonna fight you. We just they sent letters and sent diplomats to Bern asking them, would you please just let us continue in the old ways? And Burns' response was, no, and we're going to send our soldiers into your villages and forcefully eject your priests to make sure that you conform to the new religion. So like this is, and this is the backdrop to the persecution that then happens against the Anabaptists. Because what we often don't understand when we're looking at Anabaptist history is actually the perspective of the Bernese authorities, which their perspective was, this is a tremendous threat to the security of our state. Mm-hmm. Because it actually was.
So, I mean, that seems very similar to the early Christian history, the Roman attitude toward Christianity. Like, if this thing springs up and becomes powerful, this is going to create division. Mm-hmm. And we can't survive as a state if we have religious division, and so we need to stamp out Christianity by whatever means.
Yeah, but what's important to bring out is what the Anabaptist response at the time to Burns' position actually was. Right? Like, this wasn't just Burns' position. This was actually everybody's position. So Zurich had the same position. Even the states that would later accept and tolerate the Anabaptists and allow them to come and settle actually still had the same philosophy, the same belief, but they just found, I guess, sort of a compromise that allowed them to work around it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that, like, we have to be united as a people, and the Anabaptists are not compliant with the central vision of our state or of our nation, and so, like, that's not good. But what's important to consider is, what did the Anabaptists actually have to say about that? How did they actually see that? And essentially what they said is, they're actually right. The authorities are actually right in what they're saying, because a nation that's divided can't stand. But the proper place of a Christian is on the outside or on the margin. So the Anabaptists have the viewpoint that, again, the state's actually right in what they're saying. The state has to be unified. But as Christians, we're called to separate ourselves from that. And I guess, like, what does that mean practically speaking, is that we exist outside of the institution. And going back to that model, like Augustine's model, Augustine. I said Augustine earlier, so I'll stick with that.
It is fine. You can flip-flop during the middle of a conversation.
Going back to his vision of the church being a heavenly institution and the earthly institutions being a dim reflection, I think I might be remembering this wrong, but I think he also said in that the earthly institution is actually often going to be at odds with the heavenly institution because it's an earthly thing, because it can only so dimly reflect the heavenly thing. It's going to always be, like, I know he said it's going to always be imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's always imperfect, it kind of always needs these things on the outside tugging at it. And, like, the early church's vision of that, like the first millennium church, I should say, his vision of that, which Augustine would have been in the first millennium, is always that, well, that's the place of truly dedicated Christians, is actually to be a little bit on the outside and always tugging at things,
mm-hmm.
Always existing in this sort of tension. And so, like, most of the great saints and fathers of the first millennium were actually persecuted by the church. And the church recognized later on, like, that was their proper place, was to stand on the outside of the institution and tug at it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Anabaptists then turned around, and to me it seems like they're saying the same thing.
Yeah. It also is reminiscent of the husband and wife of Adam and Eve, in that Eve is the helper that opposes.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could it would be very symbolically appropriate to think of the institution as being the masculine, and then whatever is outside, marginal, waters of chaos, whatever, is that's the feminine.
Yeah.
And her job is to oppose that institution,
mm-hmm.
to challenge it, and
prevent it from becoming tyrannical.
And hopefully not get killed by it. I mean, that's obviously, like, that's the institution overstepping, creating a grievous error. because that was the job of this person on the outside, was to challenge and oppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and so I guess, like, where I'm trying to bring this whole conversation is to that point, which is to say that's actually the Anabaptist vision of the church, is that medieval vision of the church is, like, it's wholly consistent with medieval Christianity and with first millennium Christianity. And it's just this idea that there's the earthly institution of the church and there's the heavenly institution of the church. And they're kind of two separate things, kind of the same thing. It's not obvious to us how that always works out. But one thing that we know is that the Christian is the stranger. And what that means is that he's kind of always going to be at odds with these things that are over here on the earthly side of things.
You get to take a kind of comfort in that if you're the Christian who's frustrated with your church, then it would be easy to just, like, nurse your frustration and just be, like, angry and bitter and crusty about everything because the church is doing everything wrong.
Yeah.
But you can have much more peace about the situation if your attitude is, it is the nature of things for the church to do things wrong, and it is the nature of the Christian to, to challenge it in its errors, and sometimes that will go well for you, and sometimes it won't go well for you, but
right.
That's the way that things are. And so if I'm going to be the good Christian here, then I need to try to oppose what's wrong, and then whatever happens, happens.
Well, it's like the nature of being a Christian is to accept the possibility that things might not go well for me.
Mm-hmm.
And like that might actually be my service for you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, me being persecuted might be my service
right.
to you.
Yeah. And like that's, I think, where we get it flipped around is because we tend to focus so much on ourselves as Christians and our own personal Christianity that we stop to. We lose the vision that, well, the purpose of my suffering and my persecution is for the one that's causing me to suffer and is persecuting me, and
mm-hmm.
those that
mm-hmm.
follow in his institutions.
Mm-hmm. I wanna try to encapsulate a little bit of what you said, because you've talked about this. It took you a long time to get to this second layer on this, but we start with this idea that it's necessary that you have a national church,
mm-hmm.
that the people be united around one thing, although not every individual is going to be united. So it's, you gotta have this national church, but don't expect that to be the true religion. You've gotta have this national church, but you've also got to have people that are operating outside of it.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a very, very important point that we need to be aware of as modern Christians, is that you have to have the national church. Okay, so let's say you should be thankful the Catholic Church existed and still exists. You should be, like, that is very important, that the institution of the church is there. But it's also the nature of it that, well, like you said, it's that it has errors.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not mean that you destroy it. So, like, the Anabaptists, going back to them, like, I don't want this to sound like I'm idolizing the Anabaptists, but, like, here's a point, again, that they made, is that we have no interest whatsoever in abolishing the institutions of the church. We have no interest whatsoever in dividing the church. We have no interest whatsoever in starting our own church.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, and they were, and, like, Pilgrim Marpeck especially hammered by this idea that the church is and remains one. And like this is just a major, major error of the Protestants, is to divide the church.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that in Jesus and his disciples as well, that they were not seeking to create a new church,
yeah.
and to divide and separate and all that.
Mm-hmm.
They are seeking to honor the institution of, I mean, I'm using the term church here, which is a little bit anachronistic. They're seeking to like uphold the institution, uphold the traditions of the church, and also to challenge it in a very bold way.
It's another thing, it's important to throw in on top of that too, that Jesus told his disciples, he said, I can't remember exactly how it says it, but basically, like, they'll kill me, mm-hmm. and they'll strike at the flock, and the sheep will be scattered.
Right. And you know, there were accounts of Jesus going into the synagogue and teaching something and then being run out because he yeah. said something that angered a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to your example that you were just giving a little bit ago, John, about how sometimes it's not going to go your way when you do stand for something that, you know, the institution is not standing for as it should. But, mm-hmm. you know, if only it were that the modern Christian
would have. It'd be so nice to just be able to have that mentality that, like, things won't go my way when I do what is right, and that's okay. Like. Yeah.
But we do not have that mentality.
No, it's like if something's wrong, I have to have the power to change the world.
Yeah.
And you know, whatever I try to do, whatever lever I'm gonna pull, it should work. And if it doesn't, something's wrong with the rest of the world, not with me, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
But I mean, just this idea that like, it would be so much better to have this idea that, you know, my job is to do what's right. And if bad things happen, so be it.
Yeah. Well, and the realization of that can come from the idea that we're part of a kingdom that is not of this world.
Mm-hmm. You know, I like that what John said. I like it well enough that I think you should say it again and we end with it. Mm. Just because I think that's just a really good thought to leave people with.
Yeah. Do what's right. And if bad things happen, so be it.
Amen. All right, we want to thank you for joining us today on The Sacred Life, and we ask for your comments, your questions down below. Please subscribe, please share with your friends. We appreciate your feedback, and if you have anything to offer, we thank you again for joining us, and we wish you peace in Christ.